Leeds looked at Charles, and Anna saw it in his eyes as he looked at her husband. He was one of the ones who'd been hurt, one of the ones who saw that her Charles protected the helpless. Interestingly, Marsden saw it too. The hand that had been resting on his partner's shoulder tightened. Leeds glanced at him and smiled. "That's why I'm taking you with me," Leslie told her quietly. "You see a lot of things that happen without words." In a carrying voice, she said, "Okay, you goons, go find our perp. We'll rendezvous here at 1600 hours if no one finds anything worth calling each other about." As it turned out, Leslie and Anna had identical rental cars parked several spaces apart. Anna glanced at Leslie and laughed. "Guess we're gonna have to use the fob to see which car is which?"
"No," Leslie said after a moment. "Mine has a scratch on the driver's side door. It's the closer one. You might as well leave yours locked," she continued in a no-argument tone. "I'm driving."
Anna rolled her eyes.
"The mommy voice doesn't work on me," she informed Leslie. "I was raised by my dad, a very logical, calm man who explained things in a normal tone. When he swore, it was in Latin, mostly directed at my brother."
Leslie assessed her. "The only person I trust besides me to get my butt where it needs to go in safety is currently teaching second graders how to multiply by twos. Do you mind if I drive?"
"See?"
asked Anna, walking around to the passenger seat.
"Was that so hard?"
"Anna," said Leslie, "I think I could learn to get along with you just fine. Go through those files and see what you want to start with." There was a stack of files tucked in between the seats, 14 new in various colors and one faded and battered. She opened the battered one and said,
"1978? 5-year-old boy. Attempted kidnapping, except that the boy had a big dog who heard him cry out and..." She stopped. "You read that file and tell me what you think."
Anna read and thought. "This sounds right. The Fae don't like to move." Bran had told her that once. "There were a few that moved all the time, but most of them found a place and stayed if they could."
"Most of them, anyway. They don't age, and they don't change their rituals, not unless they're High Court Fae."
And to think, just a few years ago, the only thing she'd known about the Fae had come from Disney movies. "They can't."
"That's what Leed said. He said we were making this perp too human. He's the one who went digging in older files. Found 4 cases that fit, but that one was the only one where the kid escaped. This kid grew up and still lives in the Phoenix area. Teaches higher mathematics at Arizona State." She gave Anna a challenging smile. "Why don't you call him? See if we can make an appointment."
As it turned out, Professor Alexander Vaughn had just finished his 2 morning classes and had the rest of the day free. Did they want to meet him at his house? He'd be delighted to entertain an FBI agent and her consultant. They should reach his house in Tempe about the same time. Anna assured him that would be lovely.
"He didn't ask what it was about," Anna observed after hanging up.
"Could be a crime groupie," said Leslie. "Lots of people are. Could be he's bored or lonely or anything. No speculation until after we talk to him."
"FBI policy?"
"My policy. Assumptions drive an interview away from interesting places."
"All right," Anna said. "We'll go talk to the professor."
Leslie pulled up to a house that had been built in the 50s. Evidently, they had beaten the professor there. Leslie did not obey speed limits as well as Anna. She arrived 15 minutes earlier than the car's navigation system's estimate. The house was large and most notable because it was not built in the Southwest adobe style Anna's eyes were getting used to. Nor was the yard xeriscaped with the conscientious water conservation she saw everywhere. Green grass covered the very small front area, and huge old trees surrounded the house. Likely the shade from the trees was how the grass survived summers here. A Volvo older but in pristine condition, purred into the driveway and disgorged an athletic man with a military short cut that managed to tone down his bright red hair. He shut the door and took his time looking at them. Anna returned the favor. He looked a little younger than someone who had been 5 in 1978. He walked toward them slowly and said, "Can I help you, ladies?" "Professor Vaughn?" asked Leslie. He shook his head. "No. Who are you? Why are you looking for Alex?" The roar of an engine distracted them, and a big truck pulled into the driveway beside the Volvo. The truck was painted black, with bright pink flames, and jacked up high enough it wallowed when it turned. The door popped open, and a mad scientist hopped out, looking very out of place in the redneck vehicle.
"It's okay, love," he called out. "If you answered your cell phone, I'd have updated you."
The red-haired man turned to the professor, tilted his head, and said,
"I don't talk while I'm driving. And you shouldn't call while you are driving. Bluetooth or no, I don't want to get that phone call."
The mad scientist nodded, kissed the big man on the cheek, and patted his shoulder. "I'm Alex Vaughn, and this bulldog is my partner Darren Richards of the Phoenix Police Department. He worries. That's his job. There, these are the FBI. They want to talk to me."
Darren's head jerked first to his partner and then to the two women. His eyes narrowed.
"ID?" he said.
Leslie showed him her badge and he examined it. He frowned and said,
"I don't know you. I work with the local FBI office a lot."
"They brought me out especially for this case," Leslie said. He looked at Anna and she raised both hands.
"Don't look at me. I'm just a consultant."
"And you were here to speak with Alex?"
"With Dr. Vaughn," Leslie said.
"Yes."
"Dare," said the mad scientist. "It's okay."
"Maybe," he agreed, without agreeing at all.
"Why are you here?"
"We have to do this on the lawn?" asked Leslie, not losing her smile.
"Dare," said Alex, gently. "What are they going to do? Shoot me? Let's go in and have some coffee and talk."
He looked at Leslie.
"I have a stalker, a former student. She quite often calls in complaints, and we have police officers come to investigate strange noises, screaming, shots fired, you name it. The Tempe PD knows her, but occasionally she gets one through to a rookie. The fire department was here last week at 2 a.m. because she reported a fire. I guess she got tired of not getting a response."
"We're definitely not here because someone called in a complaint," Leslie said.
"We'd like to interview you about an attempted kidnapping, yours, that happened in June of 1978.
Both men's faces went blank with surprise. Darren recovered first.
"You never told me you were kidnapped. Freaking damn it, Alex. You'd have been 6 in 78. June, you'd have been 5.
"Attempted." Dr. Vaughn sounded shell-shocked. "I don't think the police even believed me. My dad installed a security system, and my mom fed the dog steak every day for a week."
"No one believed in fairies back then," Anna said. "We're all clapping our hands for Tinker Bell now, though. We have a missing child who lives 4 blocks from where you grew up. Would you mind talking to us about what happened?"
"Sure," he said, "I guess. I was 5, though, and it's been a long time."
"How about I go next door and see if your mom is home?" said Darren. "That woman has a mind like a steel trap. She'll remember what you told her when it happened."
"You think it was a fae?"
asked Dr. Vaughn.
"He was green and hairy. His hands had 6 fingers with claws on them," Anna said, matter-of-factly. She'd memorized the words on the first reading. It hadn't been hard. The boy's terror and the police officer's skepticism rang through in the dry words typewritten on paper older than Anna. She continued, "His voice was funny, like on TV sometimes. He had a long yellow tongue, and he called you a barn. He said, 'Come here, barn.'" She looked at the police officer. If someone reported it now, Darren Richards, instead of years before the Fae admitted their existence, what would you say it was?
Barn, said Darren.
Bairn means child, right? If he was in Scotland instead of Scottsdale?
Yes, said Leslie.
You go in and have some coffee, said Darren. In a gentler voice, he said,
That sure explains some of your nightmares, Alex.
You take them in. I'll be right back. The mad scientist, well, the mad mathematician, paced back and forth in the house, even though he'd seated Leslie and Anna at the table and put coffee in front of them. He had that kind of kinky hair that never lies down right, and it was about 2 inches too long or 10 inches too short to look good, especially if it belonged to the kind of person who grabbed it and twisted or pulled when he was nervous. Anna thought he was adorable. She wanted to adopt him as a big brother and give him a big hug to calm down his rising anxiety.
My dad was a cop, he said.
Leslie nodded. That was in the report.
If he hadn't been a cop, there wouldn't have been a report, Dr. Vaughn said. He believed me. By the time I was 10, I didn't know why. Hell, I kind of don't believe me now. I mean, this thing looked like it was 8 feet tall, and it ran away from my dog and a horseshoe I threw at it.
That dog impressed whoever wrote the report, Anna said. There hadn't been any photos of the dog in it, but she had a pretty good idea that B.F. dog in the report, complete with exclamation point and a penciled-in remark that read, I'd have run from that thing, too, meant it wasn't your average run-of-the-mill dog.
Yeah. Dr. Vaughn quit pacing and grinned. My dad brought him home from work one day a few years before the incident. I don't remember it, but it's one of those family stories, you know? My mom was scared of him and wanted Dad to take him back where he found it. Then that big dog walked up to her and put his nose on her foot and sighed. He stared at her until she fed him. She was a goner after that.
He smiled at the memory, then sobered. We only had him for another month or so after that. One day he just wasn't around. Maybe he was hit by a car or something. I think Dad knew exactly what happened because he never went looking for him. And hit by a car is the kind of thing you might not tell a kid. Hey, I ran across a photo of him the other day. He booked out of the kitchen, the speed an indicator of how grateful he was for the distraction, and Anna could hear him in another room opening and shutting drawers. Leslie started to say something, but Anna shook her head. She could hear people talking just outside. In a moment, Darren opened the door and escorted a tiny female version of Dr. Vaughn into the kitchen. She frowned at Leslie and Anna and sat down opposite them with regal suspicion.
Darren tells me that you were here to ask about the time something came into our yard and tried to take my son away, she said.
We think it was a fae, Leslie said. It sounds like a fae. It acted like a fae, and a fae took a little girl and left a changeling, a fetch, in her place. We're trying to find that little girl. She's 5 years old. The attempted abduction of your son is not far from where we think our girl was taken. 30-odd years might be a long time for us, but it's a minute to one of the Fae.
The stiffness left Dr. Vaughn's mother's back, and she softened.
30 years ago doesn't feel that long to me, either.
She looked up at her son's partner and said,
Sit down, Darren. I gather that Alex never told you about this?
No, ma'am, he said.
Well, I think he wanted to believe it didn't happen.
What do you think? Asked Leslie.
I think my son never exaggerated or lied about a thing in his life, no matter how uncomfortable it made him. He was 12 when he told us he liked boys instead of girls. That was right after some friend of his got kicked out of his home for doing the same. Stupid people, tossing away the most precious thing God saw fit to give them, I say.
She looked at Leslie. So, yes, I believe him. I also believe we have not been introduced. I am Mary Lou Vaughn.
FBI Special Agent Leslie Fisher,
said Leslie, as Dr. Vaughn came into the room and put a photo on the table with an air of quiet triumph.
Anna Smith, said Anna, staring at the photo of two small children trying to tug a rope from an enormous black animal. Special consultant. And that is a werewolf.
Charles sat in the front passenger seat, since Leeds had taken one look at him trying to fit in the back and said, "Hey, man, that is just not going to happen, is it? No worries. I'll catch the back seat." Charles wasn't thrilled with having a stranger behind him, but even Brother Wolf couldn't make that man feel like a threat, so he figured it would be okay. He didn't like Marsden's driving, either. He drove too fast, and he didn't have a werewolf's reflexes. But if there was a wreck, Charles figured that he, at least, would walk away, so he kept his comments to himself.
"So we've concentrated our efforts in Scottsdale because Leeds thinks that this fae probably doesn't have a huge hunting ground. The ones that steal children tend to get attached to one place even more than the usual fae."
He waited, so Charles said,
"It sounds like a reasonable way to make an impossibly big search smaller."
"Okay," Marsden said. "The first place we're going is a foster home to visit a 14-year-old girl. The girl's parents gave her up to the state, said they couldn't deal with her anymore, claimed she was possessed, things flying around the room with no one touching them, which is why we are visiting even though she's older than the girl who was taken. Her parents said she was dangerous, but the counselor who gave us this one said she was uncommunicative but showed no signs of violence. The foster mom says we're okay to talk to her as long as we do it with the foster mom in a room."
"Why isn't she in school?" asked Charles.
"Yeah," Marsden agreed. "I don't know, but we'll ask." The house they drove to looked pretty much like all the rest of the houses on the street. This was not an upscale neighborhood, but it wasn't poor either. The woman who met them at the door was a human in her mid-50s, if Charles was any judge. She introduced herself as Judy White, examined Marsden's and Leeds' badges, and frowned at Charles. She wasn't unhappy about them, but she was careful.
"Consultant," said Leeds. "No official ID."
She looked grim, grimmer, but just nodded.
"Blair's not going to talk to any of you," she said. "She came here 2 weeks ago, and she hasn't spoken a word to anyone. She doesn't eat much. If I could have a word with her parents," she sucked in a breath. "Well, don't stand out here. Come in."
She led them into a house that smelled of... Charles shut his eyes to get a deep breath. Cookies, recently baked, fresh, homemade bread, a man, a woman, three children, and someone in between. That would be the girl they were looking for. Sorrow. This house had seen a lot of sorrow, but there was a warmth to it, too. Nothing smelled like the fetch, which had carried hints of greenwood, magic, and darkness. He shut the door behind him and tried not to feel like an invading giant when the woman led them to a room with two couches and a couple of those soft, squishy chairs, the kind that could unfold with footrests. Charles would let himself be shot before he sat in one of those. They always felt like they were trying to swallow him, and they were impossible to get out of quickly. He was still trying to decide where to sit when the woman brought in a tall girl of about 14, wearing clothes that would fit a woman twice her size. She didn't look at any of them, just sat on the edge of one of the person-swallowing chairs, a pale-skinned, pale-haired girl who was little more than skin and bones. The word that occurred to him wasn't starving, but fading. This was why no one sent her to school. Even blind humans must be able to tell that she was mostly gone already. Judy White introduced Marsden and Leeds, but made no mention of Charles, and he was fine with that. He watched as Marsden and Leeds did a fair job of good cop, bad cop, Leeds unexpectedly playing bad cop. The girl saw them all right, but she said not a word and gave no reaction to anything they said.
"She's abandoned,"
something whispered in his left ear. In his right, something else said,
"Her true name." is sorrow. He did not always act upon the things the spirits told him. They were interested in this girl. They hovered, unseen, even by him, in the air around her. She could be anger, they told him. She could be vengeance, for she has much to be angry about, much to avenge. Those who should have cared for her acted for themselves when they rightly should have acted for her. She has been much sinned against. This, he thought, this half-child, half-woman, was where the sorrow that was trying to enfold this house was coming from. He'd told the cantrip agents he wouldn't talk, but he couldn't let this lie. Someone needed to help her before she chose to leave this existence. He had the sure feeling that she would be needed somewhere in the future, that terrible things would happen without her. But that was not why he chose to act. Brother Wolf liked her. He knelt on the floor at her feet, interrupting Marsden, trying to coax her to speak. Judy White leaned forward, as if she would have put herself between them, then paused as she realized this was no attack. Tempering his usual fierceness, not at all, Brother Wolf said, "Little sister, what makes your eyes weep with dry tears and your bold heart ache with pain? What service can we do for you? We will stand for you in any way you need us." And because it was Brother Wolf speaking, Charles felt the words reach through the barriers she had erected between herself and the world. She blinked at him, and no one in the room said anything as he waited for her to speak. She cleared her throat.
"I'm not your sister," she said hoarsely.
But she was confused, not reputing them. So Charles and his wolf waited. They were here to serve her, not to pull information from her, not to take. Too many people had already taken from her.
"My baby," she said, finally. "They made me. And I thought, what could I do with a baby? Her father didn't want her, and my parents didn't want her, so I let them. I should have stopped them. I should have protected her. She didn't have anyone else. She's dead. She's dead before she had a chance to be born. No one cares. They wanted to pretend that nothing was wrong."
And when she said the last word, no more than a whisper, an entire shelf of children's games fell off the bookcase they'd been on with a crash. About an hour and a half later, Charles belted himself back in the Chevy and waited for Marsden to drive. But they just sat there with the engine running for a little.
"How did you know?" Marsden said.
"I'm a werewolf," he told Marsden. "I know about all sorts of things. Wizards, humans who can manipulate the physical world aren't common, but they happen."
"Frightening for her," said Leeds, "to find out that when you get mad, things fly around. You think the woman you recommended her foster mother talk to might help her?" He sounded like he knew all about being alone with funky powers.
"I wouldn't have given her the name if I didn't."
Charles wondered what Leeds' fey blood had left him with as a legacy. But as long as he wasn't stealing children, Charles didn't care. He considered that for a moment, but he could smell Leeds' fey blood quite clearly, and it bore no resemblance to whatever had bespelled Chelsea or stolen the child.
14, said Marsden. He swore with feeling. Whoever was watching out for her should have been shot.
He paused.
"That baby's father died. Did you catch that? Hit by a car in a freak accident."
"I hope it was her," said Leeds, then almost contradicting himself. "And I hope she never knows it."
"That was powerful," Marsden said. "What you did in there, Charles.
He rubbed the steering wheel. It should have been absurd, you know, but it was powerful.
He is a dominant werewolf, said Leeds. When he submitted himself to her will, of course it was powerful. What if she had asked you to kill her parents, the ones who abandoned her? Abandoned her twice, by my accounting.
Her name was Sorrow, said Charles. All she needed was for someone to hear her, so she could mourn.
But what if?
He didn't owe Leeds that answer, especially since Brother Wolf was insulted that he would ask. Still,
what do you think? Charles said softly.
After a moment, Marsden drove away from the curb.
Could you tell me the address of the next one, Leeds?
The next one was another girl, Helena, age 13. Her parents and counselor insisted on staying for the interview. They also answered every question Marsden or Leeds asked Helena. The upshot was that they, parents and counselor, were certain that she was possessed by a demon.
Meth,
said Charles quietly into Marsden's ear. Marsden extracted them quickly.
We need help, said the counselor. You folks are supposed to know how to deal with this.
Marsden frowned at them.
Meth isn't demon possession. You change her friends and get her into a rehab program, I shouldn't have to tell you that.
He glanced at the parents.
You should also get her a better counselor.
The third child, another girl, Iris, was 5. Her single-parent father, who introduced himself as Trent Carter, was over his head and looked it. Knew it, according to the notes the counselor had given them. The girl's mother had committed suicide when she was only a toddler. Her father, in sweatshirt and jeans, looked exhausted and underweight. The little girl was dressed in a similar outfit, but in pink, and she had her hair up in lopsided pigtails. Charles let Marsden and Leeds question both parent and child without saying anything at all. The little girl was happy to talk to them, even though she bowed her head shyly when they asked her a direct question. Eventually, she showed them bruises on her wrists and legs and told them she was clumsy and fell downstairs. Her father paled and looked away. When Marsden finally looked at Charles, he shook his head. She wasn't Faye. Not what they were looking for at all. Reluctantly, the cantrip agents left the pair sitting on opposite sides of the room.
Damn, said Marsden. Did you see those bruises? We got referred by a counselor, right? Why didn't they get that girl out of there?
Leeds looked at Charles.
Why aren't you angry? I mean, when that first girl came in, the ethereal temperature of the room dropped into the subarctic zone.
Sometimes, Charles said, anger, though I am well acquainted with both it and its useful cousin, vengeance, is not the appropriate response.
Marsden opened his mouth, and Charles said,
where to next?
He got in the car and shut the door. After a pause, both agents did the same. They drove sedately away from Iris and her father.
And that, gentlemen, is an actual demon possession,
Charles said once they were well on their way.
The man? Asked Marsden. That's why he's hurting his daughter?
As if he couldn't imagine anyone hurting his own daughter otherwise. Charles hadn't wanted to like either of these men. Though he deemed them useful and perhaps necessary for his hunt, the other cantrip agents he had dealt with. But these men were decent people.
The fingerprints on the bruises were too small, said Leeds, suddenly. Those bruises, she did them to herself. I thought there was something off about her.
He paused.
Is there something we can do for them? Do you know someone you can send them to for help?
I'll look into it, Charles promised.
Okay, then, said Marsden. The next one is a boy, a teenager, and he's a long shot.
He fits neither our profile nor our neighborhood, but the counselor for this one is quite insistent that there is a problem.
Well, yes,
said Dr. Vaughn's mother mildly. Sid's great-grandfather, or some such. His human wife had just died, and the whole family was concerned about him. He wasn't eating or drinking. We thought that his alpha might just put him out of his misery. So Sid drove over to his house in his squad car, told him he was coming home with him. And when Archie turned into a wolf to discourage him, Sid said, "Fine, be a wolf. But you were coming home with me." She looked at Anna. "He just loved our kids, Archie did. Lets Alex's older sister dress him in whatever pink and frilly things she wanted, pulled a wagon for the kids, and saved my Alex's life, I think. He was cantankerous as a human, but he was the best dog this family ever had."
"I can't believe no one ever told me he was a werewolf," Alex let out a laugh. "Do you remember the Christmas turkey? No wonder you were so mad." He paused, then looked at his mother with horror. "The flea bath? You gave a werewolf a flea bath?" He was not happy about it. No wonder Dad was so upset when he got home.
"He had fleas," she said primly. "I wasn't letting him sleep in your room with fleas."
"So what did happen to him?" Dr. Vaughn asked.
"His alpha came and got him, finally. Told your dad that it wasn't healthy for a werewolf to stay in wolf form for that long. He went back to his house. Apparently the pack had kept it clean and the bills paid while he lived with us. He visited a couple of times, but he eventually had to move for work. I think that living in his house just wasn't good for him."
She pursed her lips.
"We never heard from him after that. I know your dad was unhappy, but there wasn't much we could do. Werewolves don't let humans interfere with their pack. Matters are less tense now, of course, because everyone knows about werewolves, but then I think we had a wolf watching us for a while, just to make sure no one was talking." She looked at Anna. "Are you a werewolf, dear?"
"Yes," said Anna. She didn't mind, but the unexpectedness of the question caught her off guard.
"Mom," said Dr. Vaughn, "don't do that."
"Do what, dear?"
Darren chuckled. "I love you, Mary Lou, and I need to recruit you for the PD. Our confession rate would go way the hell up."
"Do you know this werewolf's full name?" Anna asked. "He saw the Fae, and he wasn't a 5-year-old kid. Maybe he can help us if we can find him."
"Archibald Vaughn, dear."
"I'm thinking you'll have an easier time finding Archibald Vaughn than I will," said Leslie.
"Probably," Anna agreed. "Do you want me to start making calls?"
"Let's check out the rest of these first," she said after a moment's thought. "We scored big on the first one. Maybe there'll be a second."
"Okay."
Anna picked out another file and read off the address. She called the phone number of the witness before she waded through the 4-page report. No answer. She checked the paperwork and found no other phone number. She skimmed the report. This one was a clean printout on white paper.
"You've got to hear this," Anna said.
She tried to keep her voice businesslike as she quoted the witness report for Leslie. "It was a unicorn and 2 small dragons, no bigger than a poodle. Not the little ones. Well, not really the medium-sized ones either. But, you know, a big poodle. Standard. The unicorn was bigger, more like a black lab, maybe, or a big German shepherd."
"Why did we pick this one out?"
Leslie asked. Anna kept reading, this time to herself.
"Oh, here it is. She has been looking for fairies ever since she saw the green man living in her garden a couple of years ago. He never leaves, and no one else can see him, except for the dog, who jogs past every day with his owner. The dog barks at him every time he passes our witness's garden."
"All right," said Leslie. "You try that number again, and if he's not home..."
"She," Anna said. "Catherine Jameson, age 64.
There was another report behind the first. It had another witness's name on it. She reported that her dog barked every day as she passed Jameson's garden.
She didn't say anything about the unicorn and dragons.
We can at least get a look at her garden, the same way the jogging lady's dog does, right?
They were spared the indignity of skulking around Ms. Jameson's garden fence. The second time Anna tried the number, the lady answered on the first ring.
"Call me Katie," she said, her voice slurring just a bit. "Catherine was my grandmother. You want to come talk to me about a police report I made about the unicorn and dragons?"
She laughed, her voice low and husky, a sexy laugh for a 64-year-old woman.
"It's been a long time since I had to worry about a unicorn, right?"
She laughed again.
"Those dragons might burn something down, and that'd be a shame, don't you think? That's why I thought I should report them."
"Sure.
Come on over."
Ms. Jameson, call me Katie, lived in Gilbert, another Phoenix suburb about 15 minutes south and east of Dr. Vaughn's house. Leslie pulled into the spotless, half-round driveway and parked. There were two fountains in front of the house, and the whole impression given was a combination of beauty and money, both flaunted with equal abandon. Anna looked back at the road left and right and saw no sidewalks for jogging. The house, huge as it was set between two other houses that varied in architecture, if not in stucco color.
"How'd a jogger see into the yard at all?" Anna asked. "Where would a jogger run?"
"Maybe the jogger knows the unicorn and the dragons," murmured Leslie, and flew over the stone wall and looked into the garden with her dog.
She put on a practiced smile and headed for the door.
"I'll get you, my pretty,"
murmured Anna in her best Wicked Witch voice.
"And your little dog, too."
Miss Jameson was tall and had muscle under her tanned and well-cared-for skin. Her chestnut hair was cut short and expensively. She looked closer to 40 than 60. Some of that might be surgical, but not all of it. She wasn't stunning, but she was memorable. She was also wearing a holy pair of jeans with dirt on the knees and a very ratty old ASU football jersey. She smelled like alcohol, for which she apologized.
"I was out gardening and drinking when you called," she told them, "and now I'm a little drunk. I don't usually overindulge, but my divorce from husband number 3 just came through. My sister told me he was just after my money, and she's right."
She sighed.
"Yeah, I knew she was right. But he was 30. He could keep up with me, men my age."
She shook her head.
"But, as I told her, that's what a prenup is for. I guess he believed that if I thought he loved me, I'd be stupid in other ways, too. Call him red-assed, if the truth be known, and I have the photos to prove it. So he went and took nothing with him except for the liposuction on his stomach and 2 years of luxury living. I'd have paid a gigolo more for his services, but I'd have probably gotten better services."
She looked pensive. "Do you want us to come back later?" Leslie asked.
"Nah, it's all right," she said. "Waiting would only waste your time and mine. I only had 2 shots, okay, 3. But I did it on a full stomach, and I've been drinking water since you called."
Leslie looked doubtful, but Anna said,
"Look, we're not after her. We're not going to use this testimony in court. If we need real testimony, you can come back and get it."
"You sure you're okay?" Leslie asked.
"We can return later." "That stupid jogger set the police on me. Her uncle is a judge, I think. Now she's set the FBI, sure. Come in and talk to me about unicorns and dragons."
Chapter 10. They followed her into the house, which smelled like cinnamon and vanilla in a combination not quite strong enough to cause Anna distress, though she'd be glad to leave. The entryway led them into a huge circular room with hardwood floors trimmed in stone around the smallish fountain in the center of the room, and around the fireplace on the wall opposite the entryway. Other rooms opened off the main room. Anna caught a glimpse of a kitchen, a dining room, a weight room, and a room where everything had been torn out down to the studs. The drywall, shreds of carpet and bits and pieces of furniture were left in an untidy pile on the floor.
My ex-husband's office, Katie caroled as she walked by. I did the demolition myself. Better than therapy. But my contractor is sending people in the next few days to redo it and clean up the mess.
She paused, then looked at Anna and winked.
He put that carpet in for me, right after we got married. When he came in to give me a bid on repairs, he asked me what had been wrong with the carpet.
She smiled. I told him there wasn't any blood on it. Katie led them into her own office, bright and airy, with a view of a swimming pool dominating a huge backyard. Other than the pool, it was mostly xeriscaped but with patches of green hidden under fruit trees. The back fence was 8-foot wrought iron with a gate leading out to a waterway and presumably, because Anna couldn't see it from the window view, a jogging path. The office was big enough to swallow a desk and a couch and love seat with room left over. Katie plopped down on the love seat, tucking one sandal-clad foot underneath herself.
So, did she tell you that there must be a body in my garden because her dog barks at my yard all the time?
Her voice rose and sweetened.
Remington doesn't bark anywhere else, just at her garden. Remington is an intellectual genius and knows, absolutely knows, that there must be a body buried there. He's trying to tell us.
She narrowed her eyes at Leslie, and when she continued, it was in her own voice. Remington is a squat toad who pokes his nose in other people's business. If I were going to bury someone in my garden, it would have been my husband. Husband, ex-husband, but he's still alive and living in sin with his girlfriend, who is the same girlfriend he'd just broken up with when I met him. Stupid dog, stupid men, all of them should rot in hell.
So the jogger's report was first, Anna said, suddenly understanding what had happened. She has connections, so the police came to ask you about the garden.
Katie had been nodding, but she held up a finger to stop Anna.
Point of fact, they dug up my garden, and it took me 3 weeks to get it back into shape. One of my yuccas is, I'm afraid, doomed.
And so you told them that there was a fairy living in your garden,
Leslie said. Katie held up a finger.
No. I called them back at 1 a.m. and said that there was something dangerous here, something.
The police came and asked me what was dangerous. I told them I'd seen a unicorn and 2 smallish dragons running down the street, which I had. My neighbors have a trio of delightful children who like to dress up in last year's Halloween costumes. I suppose they'd escape the babysitter I saw chasing after them. Both of the dragons were carrying lighters. You know, the kind I mean, not the ones for cigarettes, but the ones for lighting a charcoal grill. The unicorn was armed only with her horn. She paused. I may have left out a few things in my story, and I might have called it in 5 or 6 hours after I first saw the unicorn. Anna saw Leslie's face and didn't laugh, though she wanted to. Leslie said coolly,
So you deliberately called police officers to your home because they inconvenienced you and kept them here when they might have been needed elsewhere?
Katie's eyes narrowed, and she lost the soft, half-drunken act entirely.
No.
I'm telling you that I called them on a possible threat. I never saw the babysitter actually corral the little hooligans, did I? 2 10-year-olds can do a lot of damage with fire lighters. It's not my fault that the police officer didn't ask the right questions. Leslie sat up straighter, and Anna interrupted her. They were here for information, a lecture on the stupidity of crying wolf, no matter how well deserved, was not going to get them anywhere.
We are not actually here about the unicorn. We're more interested in the green man in your garden, Anna said. Katie stiffened more, and her scent spiked with anxiety that was not quite fear. You needed to distract the police from your garden, Anna said. The unicorn and dragon story did that very nicely. They aren't going to want to come back here anytime soon, are they? But they've written you off as a kook. That had been quite a sacrifice for this woman who spent so much time and energy on her own appearance. But that green man comment, just a throwaway, really, has the ring of truth. And that's what brought us here. What do you have living in your backyard, Ms. Jameson?
I think I would like to call my lawyer, said Katie.
We are here because we are looking for a 5-year-old girl who was taken by a fae who left a changeling in her place, Leslie said. That fae kills children, Ms. Jameson.
You can show yourselves out, she said stonily.
Time matters, Anna told her, not mentioning that Amethyst had been missing for months already. How will you feel when we find that child's body? Will you ask yourself if she might have survived if you had cooperated? Or will you be able to shrug it off?
He has nothing to do with kidnapping children, the older woman's voice was harsh.
Maybe, Anna said, but maybe he would know who does. Maybe he could help us.
Katie looked up and Anna caught her eyes. Anna was no alpha wolf to force people to do things that they would rather not, but she was honest and stubborn. It was Katie who looked away first.
If you put anything in writing, I will make you look like a fool, Katie said.
Anna tipped her head. We have no intention of making you look foolish or getting you in trouble.
Leslie hesitated. If this has nothing to do with the girl's disappearance, there will be no need to record anything more than that we checked out your story and found it not germane to our investigation.
Katie was quiet a moment.
All right, fine. I have a touch of the sight. My mother did too, and her mother before her. My grandmother was a healer and a wise woman. My mother, she had migraines during which she would see things. Some of them happened, some of them didn't. She thought she was getting glimpses of likely futures. Me? I can see the fae for what they are, whatever guise they are wearing. And I have hidden it from them because they don't like she-seers. If you give me away, my life will be very short.
Understood, Leslie agreed.
Katie Jameson strode past the big pool with its attendant fountains, hot tub, and assorted pool chairs, bar and barbecue, a full-service pool. Instead, she aimed at the small green corner in the back of her yard. 3 huge palm trees formed the upper canopy, and huge clumps of lavender nearly waist-high lined the 8-foot stone wall that separated Katie's yard from the next house over. There was some kind of bush in between the lavender with pretty orange flowers, but there was no denying that the most spectacular plant was a huge orange tree, craggy with age. It sprawled arrogantly over the wrought iron fence into the jogging path, its branches laden with green fruits that were just starting to turn orange. It was obviously older than the yard it presided over, older than the housing development, the jogging path, and the 3 other fruit trees next to it, too. Anna, though no gardener, thought that the other fruit trees, though much smaller, were pretty old, too. She paid attention to the messages that her nose was giving her. Over the faint scent of lavender, though most of the lavender was not yet in bloom, over the unripe fruit and the orange-flowered what's-it, she smelled something wild, something magic, something fae.
These people want to talk to you, said Katie, staring directly at the decorative and effective gate between the yard and the canal and jogging path. It's about a missing child. I don't think they care about you being here at
Yes, I know it was stupid, but I didn't torment that damn dog on purpose for months either.
Apparently, Katie was a she-hearer as well as seer, because even Anna's enhanced ears couldn't hear the person she was talking to. Her eyes caught on the great orange tree and stayed there. The trunk was bent and twisted with knots where limbs had been cut years ago. The oranges were plum-sized and green. Anna didn't know much about the vegetation in Arizona. A few quiet afternoons in Asil's greenhouse in Montana had given her a working knowledge of rare roses and a handful of flowers and plants that appeal to the old wolf. The only fruit tree he had was a waist-high dwarf clementine that Asil said was a tribute to his Spanish heritage, and the oranges he used to grow on some farm he'd owned at one time or another. Katie turned back to them. "He likes to play games," she said. "He told me that if you can find him, he'll answer 3 questions."
"Agreed," Anna said. She pulled her cell phone out and texted a quick message to Charles so he wouldn't worry when he felt her change.
"I am not my husband," she told Leslie. "I'm going to change to my wolf shape. Unlike him, I probably won't be able to change back for a couple of hours after this."
"You can't just..." She tapped her finger to her nose. Anna shook her head. "If it were that easy, he wouldn't be making a deal. Just remember to phrase your questions very carefully. Take your time. The Fae always answer truthfully, but not always completely. If they can deceive you with the truth, they will. Don't ask rhetorical questions, because those will count." She stepped to the side of the big tree, where she was hidden from the sight of people outside the yard, and began stripping her clothes off.
"This will take a while," she warned them.
"What are you doing?" Katie said, as Anna kicked off her shoes.
"I'm a werewolf," Anna told her. "I'm changing into my wolf. The wolf's nose is better and less easily confused."
The moon was almost full, so her change should have been easy. Pain, as her body rearranged itself, was now an old friend. It slid over her head with hot hands that dug in and cracked her jaw so forcibly that the pain of the rest of her body seemed gentle by comparison, until her shoulders slipped out of their sockets at the same time. On a moon night, with the pack gathered together, pack magic shielded the sounds the changing wolves made in their pain, and the moon could sometimes change pain to ecstasy. But alone, and in the full Arizona sun, Anna was obligated to make no noise that might attract attention. She was good at not attracting attention. Some changes were better than others, regardless of the moon's phases, but this was much, much worse than any shift she'd done this near the moon's call. Before pain drove her to the single determination of silence, Anna belatedly recognized the wariness her wolf felt that drove her to speed the change. The wolf could not adequately defend herself while caught between forms. Anna had chosen to change in front of a virtual stranger and a fae she could not see and knew nothing about. A fae who could be the very creature they were hunting. Anna trusted Leslie to have her back, but the wolf was more judicious in her trusts, and Leslie was not pack, nor anyone they were long acquainted with, so speed was necessary and pain was a small cost to pay for safety. When it was over, Anna lay winded and shaky, which wasn't exactly a safe thing either. She rolled to her feet and shook off the last of the muscle twitches. She couldn't tell how long it had taken. Pain made time subjective. She stretched, sliding her claws out until they dug into the soil. Satisfied that her body was working, she turned her head to look at the 2 women, who stood carefully, not looking at her.
"Are you all right?"
Leslie asked, when Anna moved around so she could look the FBI agent in the face.
"That sounded like it hurt,"
We could hear your bones break.
Anna sneezed and let her tail wag. Katie looked at Anna and then quickly away again, her hand over her mouth.
It wasn't.
Her voice stuttered to a stop, and then she made a break for her house. Anna sighed. Yes, werewolves are monsters, and the change isn't pretty. Unfair to ask the mundanes to deal with it. She'd had no choice.
Can you find the Fae? Leslie asked.
I assume the deal is still in effect. If you find him and we can't communicate, I'll go back in the house and drag Miss Jameson back out.
Yes. Finish this business,
thought Anna. She checked out the big tree first, though it was too obvious. It smelled of Fae magic, no question. But to her wolf nose, the whole yard smelled of Fae. She trotted the circumference of the yard and played a little hot and cold with herself to make sure she was right that the Fae was somewhere near that big orange tree. The scent of the Fae, who did not smell like Chelsea's house or the daycare, faded as soon as she got to the house end of the swimming pool. She quartered the yard around the pool and ended up back by the orange tree. Not the butterfly bush, not the granite rock that was decorated with small pots of herbs where the sides of the boulder made natural shelves, not the handful of tea rose bushes, not the yuccas, which did indeed show signs of being dug up and replaced. Everything smelled of the Fae, but not enough. Anna backed away and looked carefully for something she had missed.
Where?
She asked herself, asked her wolf spirit.
Where is he?
The wolf focused on one of the lemon trees, the smallest and scruffiest of them. Like the yuccas, it looked as though it was suffering from rough handling. She closed in on it, shut her eyes, and let her nose lead her across the stone walkway and onto the gravel that covered the earth around the plants.